Welcome to the Thinking Practitioner Podcast,
a podcast where we dig into the fascinating issues, conditions, and quandaries in the massage and manual therapy world today.
I'm Whitney Lowe.
And I'm Till Lucas.
Welcome to the Thinking Practitioner. Hi, this is Whitney Lowe, and thanks for joining us on the Thinking Practitioner Podcast, where Books of Discovery has been part of the massage therapy education world for over 20 years. Thousands of schools around the world teach with their textbooks and digital resources, and in these trying times, this beloved publisher is dedicated to helping educators with online-friendly digital resources that make instruction easier and more effective in the classroom or virtually. Books of Discovery likes to say, learning adventures start here. They see that same spirit here on the Thinking Practitioner Podcast, and they're proud to support our work, knowing we share the mission to bring the massage and bodywork community enlivening content that advances our profession.
Check out their collection of e-textbooks and digital learning resources for pathology, kinesiology, anatomy, and physiology at booksofdiscovery.com, where Thinking Practitioner listeners save 15% by entering Thinking at checkout. How you doing, Whitney?
Very well today, sir. How are you doing?
Excellent.
Good to have you back here. I was off and I missed you deeply last week.
You were solo. Thanks for doing that.
Yeah, I had a good talk with Jamie Johnson and Eric Purvis from Canada, and but we missed having you there, and great to see you back. You've been rafting, from what I understand, right?
Down the Green River in Utah. Rafting upwind, it turns out, so my biceps got a real workout. Paul Kelly, I was totally thinking of you on that trip, but it was fun to be away, so thanks for covering for me.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we're not alone today. We have a exciting guest.
All right, let's hear about it.
Todd Hargrove, thanks for being with us. You have a blog and podcast of your own, Better Movement. I'll say a little bit about it. We actually haven't met until just now, but I heard your name a long time ago. Someone said, Till, you should meet this guy, Todd. He's got some background in rolfing and he thinks different, like you're thinking different or something like that. I said, okay, that sounds cool. And then it was Greg Lehman who first said even more. He talked about how you were giving him a hard time for being a movement nihilist, which I thought was a really interesting and good point.
Yeah.
And so then, yeah, I've never actually had the chance to catch up with you, so I'm excited to talk to you. You actually wrote a fun little article about neuroinflammation and the concept there of, I'll let you talk in a second, but the concept there of the neuroimmune system is really fascinating. How, at least this is my take, I want to hear yours, but the take of how the immune system and the nervous system work together and are both parts of, say, a bigger whole, a bigger function that's basically about protection. And that might even include social behaviors and such. But anyway, that's my interest. That's what piqued my interest. And you touched on a couple of those things in your article about neuroinflammation. So now that I've said all that, what do you want us to know about you before we dig into some of those things?
Well, first that I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me. I've heard your name for a long time too, and I've met Whitney before, but first time meeting you. So I do have a background in rolfing. I've going all the way back. I have a background of being an attorney. I was doing that for about 10 years. And then I started to experience some chronic pain, which got me interested in the body and why it might be hurting. And I was already kind of interested in the body from playing sports, and that got me kind of interested in movement, both of those things, because around the time I was getting into, you know, this stuff was around 2005, there was a lot of athletic trainers that were talking to physical therapists and physical therapists that were talking to athletic trainers, and kind of the idea was that, you know, the way you move is related to the way you feel, and I just found that really interesting. And I, at the same time, I was looking into kind of like yoga and kind of martial arts kind of stuff and different functional training things. And I got a session of rolfing done by a guy named Brad Jones here in Seattle. And, you know, I had a great experience doing that. And anyway, you know, long story short, I started to move a lot better. I started to feel a lot better. I got interested enough in the whole thing that I was like, I'd rather do this than be an attorney. So I went to school to learn how to be a rolfer in 2005. Shortly after that, I went to did some extra training to be a Feldenkrais practitioner. So I've been doing both of those things, kind of practicing in kind of my own kind of Rolfing-ish, Feldenkrais-ish way for, I guess, about 15 years, seeing people here in Seattle, and also doing some writing on a blog at Better Movement, and now Todd Hargrove at Substack, and writing a few books, and, you know, coming into contact with other people like you guys and talking and geeking out. And
cool. Well, we'll make sure we get links to all that stuff in the show notes, but that's great to get a picture of your course into this stuff. And what a interesting combination of influences. And you did the Rolf training first and then went and trained as a Feldenkrais practitioner. That's a small set of people that includes some of my mentors. I mean, my own, I trained with Thomas Hanna about the same time I was training with students of Ida Rolf's at the Esalen Institute in the 80s. So that was always a big influence in my my thrust as well. So it's interesting.
Yeah, well, Schleip too, Robert Schleip. When I was when I was at school, that's when I first came into contact with his work, and that I found influential. I mean, he's a Feldenkrais guy, and his idea that, you know, what we're doing with Rolfing is kind of like, you know, actually to use the phrase, I think, by Yocan and Rye Werent, who's one of Feldenkrais's students, he said that what we're doing here is about information, not deformation. And that was kind of like Schleip's idea as well, is that when we're putting an elbow on somebody, it's not about melting and deforming and as much as it is sending information and asking for permission. And that idea is kind of like that paradigm is really kind of the way I've thought about, you know, body work and different types of movement work. And that's what kind of led me to really thinking about the nervous system, you know, really, really thinking about the nervous system. And it was kind of later that I came to appreciate a little bit more that, hey, the immune system works really, really, really closely with the nervous system. And so this idea of neuroinflammation is kind of like expanding out from that base of thinking a lot about, you know, the nervous system.
Well, tell us some more about how you got interested in it, why you took the time to write a blog piece about it. And, you know, especially how it relates to manual therapy. We'll get into that too as we go along, if you like.
Yeah. So you know, back to the neuroimmune system idea, you know, what I became interested in with chronic pain. Well, I mean, my first idea of why something hurts that I had when I was hurting and when I first got started practicing is there's something wrong with the body, you know? Uh-huh. So like if your knee hurts, there's something wrong with the knee. If your back hurts, there's something wrong, with your back. And that's not necessarily wrong, but it's only part of the story. Part of
something wrong being like damage or being used poorly.
If there's something wrong with your knee, there's damage, something in the knee. There's something wrong with your back, there's damage in the back. But
gotcha.
You know, as I learned more, oh, it's also about the sensitivity of the nervous system, how it's reading information from that area. And it can be sensitized and kind of like read more threat than is actually there. I found that idea very interesting. And, you know, you study more and you realize that a lot of what's getting the nervous system sensitive is the activity of the immune system. You know, like very obviously, one obvious idea would be peripheral inflammation. So if you're inflamed in your knee, that's sensitizing the nociceptors in the knee and changing the sensitivity of the nervous system. But you can also have inflammation within the nervous system, within the central nervous system. That's basically what neuroinflammation means, is inflammation in the central nervous system, and that can change the sensitivity of the nervous system as well.
So that's an important distinction. I just want to underline for a second there. You're talking about how peripheral inflammation, like in your knee, can sensitize the nociceptors there, the nerve endings there, so they generate more signal, perhaps, or the signal threshold is lower, whatever it is. But then you're making the distinction saying, like, in the central nervous system, that could be going on too. There could be inflammatory mechanisms at work that make us just more sensitive overall, as well as maybe more reactive.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, part of what I learned is that, you know, in the brain, for example, only about something like 10% of the cells there are neurons that, you know, are conveying the electrical information. Many, many, many of them are the glial cells.
Right.
And they're kind of holding the neurons in place and giving them nutrition and helping with transmission and repairing damage and stuff like that. And they play a role in helping the neurons do what they do. They might be involved in learning and memory, Again, they can sensitize the transmission of nociception, and you know, there's a balance there. They do they're doing, you know, they have a, you know, important role to play in keeping everything healthy there. Some of them are microglia that are kind of like looking for infections and repairing damage and always like surveying their environment.
Some immune cells of the brain, as it were.
Yeah, yeah. And but when they get, you know, excessive what they're doing, just like the inflammation throughout the body, inflammation plays a, you know, valuable role in clearing infections and, you know, repairing damage. It can become chronic. It can become more excessive than it needs to be to get the job done. And that can play a role in bad health, you know, in the periphery and in this. The same applies to the central nervous system.
So I'm curious, Todd, when you say the inflammation within the central nervous system causing sensitization elsewhere, would we tend to see that show up as like overall greater sensitivity to all kinds of sensory stimuli throughout the body? Or like, let's say, you know, a person's knee hurts and maybe there's some relationship there with, you know, neurogenic inflammation or within the nervous system, where that inflammation is occurring. Does that tend to show up in broader areas when it's, you know, within the whole nervous system as opposed to like a small local peripheral instance?
Yeah, I understand that the central sensitivity that can happen at the dorsal horn is partly mediated by the activity of glial cells around there. Mm-hmm. I should point out that discussion of the immune cells and all this physiology is super complex, and I'm just kind of starting to learn about it. And there's a, you know, you read one of these papers on neuroinflammation and you encounter, you know, 10 and 20 and 30 descriptions of different kinds of cells that are involved, like the IL-6, yeah, the IL-7, and up to IL-10, and all of them do slightly different things. So it's an enormously complex system. I'm just kind of scratching the surface here in terms of like my knowledge of like what's going on at the micro level. Mm-hmm. And I think of this as kind of like an interesting piece of a part of a larger picture, which is that, you know, the nervous system works with the immune system, works with the endocrine system in protecting the body. And there's just a wide variety of bad feelings we can have that are associated with one or more of these systems getting overprotective.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You, on a recent episode of your podcast, had a really good interview with Bronnie Thompson, where you were talking about fibromyalgia and some of those other widespread body pain problems possibly being somewhat linked to some of these concepts and ideas. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. That one of the interesting things about neuroinflammation, and the reason why I say it's kind of like if you were going to look at any one kind of micro piece of this big picture that I think is easier to understand, that micro piece would be neuroinflammation keeps showing up, if you look for it, in the brains of people who have a wide variety of chronic complex health conditions like chronic pain, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, cognitive problems like dementia. It keeps being there wherever you look for it, kind of like the way chronic inflammation is there in a lot of different chronic health problems that are more peripheral in nature. Mm-hmm. And it's something that starts to catch your attention after a while. It's kind of a common player or a common currency in these things. And I think that we should kind of have our eye out for that term and be looking for it, because once you start looking for it, you'll be seeing it in lots of different places.
Yeah.
Well, just let's not miss the chance to clarify some of those signs. I mean, you named a few conditions there that we're really starting to wonder or suspect or see that neuroinflammation can play a role in, but what are some of the other signs or client complaints or issues that you'd say, oh, maybe that's one of the mechanisms at work here?
Well, I think those ones that I just mentioned are the ones that I know about it. But when you see clients that have conditions that have been going on for a long time, not easily explained or reduced to a particular diagnosis, but you know, they've been to a lot of doctors, they're wondering what it is, their symptoms seem to come and go without rhyme or reason. Maybe the symptoms seem to be related to a traumatic event that happened, either emotional or physical. Yep. Or it happened after a serious infection.
There you go.
Or if there's autoimmune components involved, If there's anxiety or depression involved, you know, if you see a lot of people who have had problems for a while and they're not sure what they are, it becomes more and more likely that they have one of these conditions. And anytime you have one of these conditions, it greatly increases the chances of having some of these other conditions. So they all kind of run together. You know, some of them are more recognized as a disorder of the nervous system. So one might be more about the immune system, like autoimmune. One might be kind of like an endocrine system thing. But all these systems really talk to each other. And the regulation, what one being in a regulated, balanced state is necessary for the others to be as well, which is maybe why all of these conditions can be kind of comorbid.
And with the common thread being the probable inflammatory activity in the central nervous system, increasing the sensitivity and the reactivity of those responses, and with pain being one of those signs. So mm-hmm. pain out of proportion to a stimulus, perhaps, or reactivity out of proportion to the noxious stimulus.
Or fatigue out of proportion to the amount mm-hmm. you're exerting yourself, or worrying out of proportion to the amount that there's really something to worry about, or being sad more than a normal person would be sad under the circumstances. Those are all, I like to think about all the different ways that the body can protect itself from perceived harm. And when you're, one of them is sleeping, when you've, you know, your body's always protecting itself against running out of energy. And so it needs to make you tired and make you go to sleep when it perceives that energy stores are low. It needs to make, you know, pain is there to get you to stop moving and protecting something. Anxiety and worry and low mood are there to get you to start thinking about how to solve problems. And all of those protective mechanisms can start to become, you know, maladaptive and overprotective. And anytime you look at one of them, you see neuroinflammation involved.
So I'm curious too, this is, you know, it's fascinating physiology to delve into this. And, you know, those of us who are kind of geekly interested in this kind of stuff can really get, you know, down a rabbit hole with it. But from a like a day-to-day clinical perspective for the practitioners who are out there in the trenches doing stuff, are there any real key indicators or signs or symptoms that you can describe as something that would point to a greater involvement of something like neuroinflammatory activity within the central nervous system or something?
Yeah, well, I mean, when people have pains that are not well localized, mm-hmm. they move around, they're just not well correlated with what you would suspect would be tissue damage in an area. Now, I mean, mm-hmm. like if someone comes in and say, I twisted my ankle last week and it hurts right in that exact spot now, and it hurts when I move it like this, then that's the, like maybe the prototypical example of a pain that's obviously related to a local tissue damage problem.
Yeah.
But when you've got pains
or tissue sensitivity problem, at least.
Yeah.
Or tissue sensitivity. Yeah. But when you've got the pains that move around and they're also connected to psychosocial issues and they're connected to energy level issues, if there's also comorbidities of the kinds that I just talked about with the anxiety and the depression and the autoimmune disease, that's when I start to suspect that we've got more kind of a systemic dysregulation type of a situation. And it gets me thinking much less about targeting that local area where it hurts and much more about general health.
Nice.
And just kind of helping people troubleshoot and strategize and think about ways in which they might be able to improve their general health. And the obvious things here are the way you sleep, the way you eat, the way you exercise, reducing stress, optimizing your weight, avoiding toxins like alcohol, drugs, and pollution.
You just gave the punchline to the whole joke right there. That's what all this is building up to. I know, but back it out a little bit and keep looking at what goes on there. Because I do want to make really clear that distinction between, say, chronic pain in general or other kinds of, you know, pain syndromes and neuroinflammation, which might be just one, you know, explanatory factor or mechanism there. They're different, but we're kind of talking about them as if they're similar. There are a lot of similarities, but the classic distinction you mentioned too, like a pain that moves around, that's such a clear example sometimes to clients or patients too, that, well, maybe it isn't just the tissue that's part of this. If something hurts and then it changes quickly, wow, maybe it wasn't because the tissue was injured after all. Maybe it was more of a sensitization or nervous system phenomenon.
Yeah, and they can understand that. I mean, part of helping people who have, you know, what I would think of as being this more systemic general health issue, part of helping them is helping them understand that that's what it's about. And tons of them, a lot of them will. I mean, they've been to a lot of doctors, and they, you know, they know that something is going wrong besides just, you know, something being out of place somewhere.
Well, yeah. And what you're saying, though, is really important. You're asking us to think generally about general symptoms. You're asking us to think systemically about symptoms that seem to be transitory, move around, influence the whole way someone's feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's kind of like two mindsets. I mean, there's certain types of problems, which are complicated problems, which are the kinds of problems that mechanics fix in cars. So someone's got a problem with their car, it's making a noise, it's not running, you take it in, and the mechanic is able to identify the one thing that's wrong, use their special tests, and identify that one factor out of the many different interrelated factors in that engine, which is going a problem, and then intervene on that one thing in relative isolation to all the other things. And clients come in and they want that. And we want to do that as therapists as well. And occasionally we can do that when they've got that really peripheral type of a problem. But when they've got the type of a problem which is more systemic, which is more about dysregulation, which is more about the way many, many, many different things are relating to each other, the problem is more like, you know, I like to think in terms of analogies of maybe like, you know, what's going wrong in our society with polarization? What's the one thing that's wrong there?
Yeah.
I don't know, man. That's a dynamic problem. That's lots of things. If you intervene on any one part of that system, you probably won't solve the whole problem. The system's just gonna, you know, stabilize in whatever, you know, kind of attractor state that it's in. And complex health problems can be like that. So you shift your mindset to much more higher level, you know, not the micro level, but kind of like the higher level general health kind of stuff.
Well, you mentioned mechanics, and so I got to weigh in there because I was a mechanic for a while, and
I didn't know that.
Yeah, in college, I worked my way through college as a foreign car mechanic with a fuel injection specialty.
Cool.
So
can I bring my car over to you?
we can talk, but here's the deal: not even that is cause and effect, is linear, is mechanical. Mm-hmm. I mean, any good mechanic can tell you all sorts of strange stories that are clearly systemic or system phenomenon going on.
Really?
Where it's not. Yeah. Oh yeah. My God. Yeah.
Interesting. I got to stop using that. I got to maybe change my example there.
Well, I mean, it's a flat tire and you got a nail, you take it out, it's clear. Yeah. But we, as practitioners, we want to find that nail. We always want the one thing, and the clients or patients want that too. They want to know, what is that problem? But in a case of a flat tire, it might be clear, but especially when you start getting into engines and electronics involved, it's a complex situation that can be multi-causal and multivariable. And to tease that apart involves that kind of higher thinking you're thinking about, or at least a backing off away from looking for the one cause and the one fact and being open to more systemic influences. They're sometimes even just as simple, but are a bigger picture.
I think it would kind of zooming out my perspective. I like to kind of be aware of what, you know, when I'm, there's so many different ways to look at pain. And one of the distinctions I like is sometimes you're looking at a micro level, you're looking at what's happening with cells, like some of what you can study with neuroinflammation, and some is the really zoomed out person level where you're thinking about the person's mood or their intentions or things like that. And it's kind of nice to know where you are in your Zoom level and kind of know how to toggle back and forth.
And to understand that all these things are connected. You talked, you know, the emotional states are another part of the protective or reactive system that we have. You're describing that. I mean, we got the nervous system, which helps us change our behavior around pain. If it's hot, we pull our finger out of the fire. We got the immune system, which changes behaviors of cells and fluids and signaling devices inside of our body to protect us in different ways. And then we have, I don't want to go too far with this. You mentioned polarization, but you have the social immune idea too, which has some interesting things to say about xenophobia or ways we perceive other or even civilization as an infectious disease mechanism, control mechanism. You know,
yeah.
through
yeah. Well, the whole COVID thing is a great analogy for, you know, the body freaking out when there's a major infection or there's some sort of major trauma. All these different protective systems get activated. Yeah. One tends to hype up the others, and there's this positive feedback loop, and that creates the emergency response.
Yeah.
For better, for worse. And then there can be a PTSD thing too, when, you know, what's supposed to happen when after these protective systems get activated is that they should take care of the problem. And then there should be an all clear signal issued by the system, which tells all of these protective systems when to start calming down again.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's going to be a time, hopefully soon, when we don't need to wear masks, but a lot of people will continue to wear them because they've got some kind of a PTSD. And that happens in the body too.
Yeah. Todd, I'm curious for your thoughts on this too, in terms of trying to find some resolution for some of these kinds of issues. What you said a moment ago, you and Till were talking about the mechanic analogy, and it got me thinking too, in terms of the way that the healthcare system is set up, at least in our country and in a number of other countries as well, to look for those really narrowed down fine problems so that you can have a particular diagnostic code and get your insurance reimbursement for that. And that also leads the treatment for those problems to become, in many instances, I think, overly narrow, focused on one particular type of site or problem, which may be only a piece of the more global picture. And what I wonder is, it seems like a lot of these other sort of, if we call them alternative practices, which involve, you know, all the stuff that we do, you know, massage therapy, body work, you know, Rolfing, Feldenkrais, all those kinds of things, which are more global interventions, which might address a number of different parts of the body simultaneously, trying to look at more big picture treatments. Is that one of the reasons maybe that these kinds of approaches tend to be more effective with some of these kinds of things than a lot of the other approaches that are more narrow, because a lot of people are quite dissatisfied with what happens in the traditional healthcare system trying to get these kinds of things addressed?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. If you go to the alternative healthcare people, they tend to be more, you know, quote, holistic. They look at more high level things. They're more integrative thinkers. And then when you get the medical science, they tend to be more under the microscope. It's a little bit more reductionistic. And, you know, there's trade-offs from those two different perspectives. When you look at something on the microscope, you can be extremely precise and measure exactly what's going on and be very confident that, you know, what you're describing is the reality. And the higher level, more complex entities you look at, there's kind of less precision. It's harder to measure what's happening. There's so many variables, you can't measure them all. You use kind of amorphous terms to describe what's going on, like perception of threat you use more kind of metaphors to understand what's going on. And, you know, you gain the advantage of seeing more of the picture, but you're seeing the whole picture in less resolution and with less measurement and precision. So, when that reductionistic biomedical perspective fails, that's when people go to alternative people who are going to have no problem talking about how thought is related to emotion, is related to the immune system, is related to what you eat and all this kinds of stuff. And that might not be so easy to measure and make sense of when you're going for the biomedical science. But I think these two different levels need to talk to each other as much as possible so they can help each other with the strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah, a whole lot more. Yeah, getting out of our silos and learning some multiple languages and interaction skills for sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's so much that is being done and so many ways that those conversations are happening. I mean, that what you described there is the kind of classic stereotypical siloing of our complementary or conventional ways of looking at things. But I just remember going through my own chronic health condition with Lyme disease and saw dozens of practitioners. And then looking back after it finally resolved for me, there was not a clear distinction between conventional and complementary in terms of how they dealt with me as a person or with my emotions. Some of the most emotionally inclusive practitioners were the most conventional, interestingly enough.
Yeah.
And some of the most dogmatic or reductionist ones were the most, quote, alternative as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So it's something, like you said, about the willingness to look back, take step back and think there could be lots of factors here, including the way does people feel and think about it and behave, as well as these very clear biomechanical mechanisms.
Well, yeah.
Well, another thing about the way people feel and think and behave, and that just relating to people on the person level, that's one of the most actionable levels, right? So, I mean, if you're relating to someone as a person, not only are you understanding the role that emotions and thoughts play in how they're doing, well, I mean, you're working at the level where you might actually be able to affect them and affect their behavior. And that's, you know, you can measure what's going on under the microscope, but that doesn't tell you how to change behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Lots there. Lots there. I mean, you're just making me think about all the interest now and say co-regulation and, you know, Porges' work about how it's the connection that helps us regulate our autonomic state, et cetera. Anyway, that wasn't what the conversation was going to be about, but that's where my mind just went for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, when I idea of there being excessive levels of protection, it's something that informs a lot of your interaction, because kind of like as a baseline idea with someone that I'm working with is that I want them, I just want to give them as much good news as possible about their body, you know, anything
nice.
You know, based in the truth, not based in false promises or lies or anything like that. But if they have some range of motion that they didn't know they have, I want them to know that it's there. If they have some reasonable hope that something can get better when they don't currently have that hope, I want them to know that. You know, for example, you've got the people, I've got the knee of a 70-year-old, I can't run. I've got good news for you. I don't think that's true. Let's talk about the science about that.
Mm-hmm.
Or people who think that they can't bend their back in a certain way, and you can kind of like show them that that's possible. Or you could just show them that someone cares about them and you know, is going to listen to their problems, is just something they might not know, unfortunately, even after I've been to a lot of medical professionals before.
Yeah.
And just all of that good news is just a way to lower threat, you know, one way or the other. To me, that's like a baseline thing we can do.
You're talking about that basic way of mirroring or reframing people's experience back to them in a way that actually could help them shift the way they think about it as being okay, as opposed to being flawed or damaged.
Yeah.
You're talking, and you're talking too about building capacity and building trust and resilience in people's own capabilities, their own, you know, sense of what they have.
Yeah.
But this is really, I mean, it's so subtle what comes through, because I mean, it's in our tradition as Rolfers, it was so common to feel something, go, oh yeah, feel that, oh geez. Basically saying, you know, in all 15 different ways, you're messed up here. You know, oh yeah, feel that, oh got it, geez, yeah, we're gonna deal with that or whatever, you know, which has always been one of my pet peeves, having been on the receiving end of that and going, well, what's he feeling? Oh god, I know it's messed up there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that's kind of like giving people bad news, I guess, but you could say, you could draw people's attention to the good things that are going on in the body that they might not have noticed, you know, that kind of thing as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you can also kind of like communicate to people that here's something that my clients this information might be useful from time to time, is that, you know, they want to take care of this physical problem they've got in their body. And they, I mean, everyone knows that sleep's good for you. Everyone knows that you're not supposed to do drugs and stuff like that. But if they understand that there may be more connection between these things, then they can maybe be more motivated to work on those types of things. So I've had some people that are like, for example, you know, they're not doing their daily walk. You know, I used to like to walk a lot. I don't really have time for it now. I liked it because I got out in nature and it was a little bit of exercise every day. And sometimes they're interested to know, you know what, putting that half an hour walk back in every day might be part of solving the problem that you've come to me to get solved, which you didn't realize was connected to things like walking, because these things are connected.
Do you think that the challenge of trying to get some of this kind of stuff across really needs subtleties and fine points of communication that are oftentimes not polished in many of the practitioners who might be seeing a lot of these people? I mean, it seems like one of the challenges that I hear and notice a lot is sort of unskilled attempts at trying to give lifestyle advice and guidelines and things like that in ways that is empowering for people, but not, you know, either blaming them or putting them into a pathological mindset and that kind of thing.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of skill there, and you can develop it a lot. But you know, everyone's got people skills that, you know, sometimes we get confused by thinking, you know, oh, I've got to be a psychologist or something like that. But we're all people, and we've all got tons amount of people skills, more than others. But I do think that there one common mistake that gets made, that I certainly made a ton, is the, just like you said, is the kind of the blaming and the thinking that they just need more information. And I think once you learn something about kind of motivational interviewing, that really kind of can set you straight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just say something.
Indirect approach.
Mm-hmm. Indirect approach. Can you give an example? Can you say?
Well, it's just, I mean, you know, most, for example, like, you know, most people are not overweight because they don't understand that being overweight's bad for their health. So, I mean, you can't help people by saying, hey, do you know what? That's really unhealthy.
Right.
Or, you know, you can't say, hey, you know what? You'd be healthier if you exercise and stuff like that. So you kind of have to ask, and you can't just give people certain motivations and change their behavior. You've got to work with whatever their current level of motivation and behavior is, and understand that change is hard, and it only happens with, a certain amount of commitment. And some people, you got to kind of sense when people are ready to change and what direction they're maybe already wanting to move to change. And, you know, they're like a ship that's moving in a certain direction. You can only alter it a little bit. So you need to know where it's going.
And that implies an appreciation for all the factors behind why it's going the way it is, and a sense of timing, and a sense of, I mean, I, one of my own personal working assumptions is that it's not as hard as we think it is. And that's just a helpful assumption that I try to live from in my own sense.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's like there's something about complex problems that suggests simple common sense solutions.
Yeah.
That's kind of stuff that we already know. And you know, sometimes the clients kind of already know this stuff too, but they've gotten distracted by looking for, you know, like what you said before, the nail in the tire. That really fancy, complicated answer. And so they're kind of ignoring those more kind of basic general health interventions, which might maybe should be the focus of attention.
Okay, so how do we help people? Here's the working question I work with too. How do we help people with those basic health considerations, sleep, diet, activity, stress, probably a fifth in there, with as manual therapists, from the assumption that it can actually be simple and straightforward and within our scope of practice. There's enormously complex and sophisticated ways of doing that, but yeah, there's also got to be really simple, direct, clear, and within scope ways. What do you think?
I think the biggest lever you've got is just the information that these things could be part of your solution.
Information. Okay.
So, I mean, I've got most of my clients that get to me, this is just my kind of client, are very well-resourced people, educated, you know, they've got money, they shop at Whole Foods, they're interested in health, they're already sold on all this stuff being good for them.
Yeah.
So that type of person, probably better resource than a lot of people in being able to do that. Probably a lot, there's a ton of people in the world that don't have the time, don't have the energy to be able to all of a sudden start exercising or eat better or have the money to do that or anything. So it totally depends on the person. But there are some people that are kind of like ready, willing, and able to make some sort of change like this if they only know that there's a good reason to do it.
And yeah,
maybe you could help give them that good reason. That would be the easiest way to help someone.
And sometimes when they realize that they can be part of the solution too.
Yeah, exactly.
That there's actually...
Exactly.
There's simple things you could do, like, oh, take a walk, that actually might be related to what you're talking to me about.
Yeah. And you know, even easier than, you know, fixing the problem by taking a walk would be learning about the problem by taking a walk and just seeing how you feel.
I like it.
I have a lot of people that are like, you know, I used to feel better, you know, whenever, last year. And then I've gained from the history, you know what, I remember you told me you were walking a ton last year and you had to stop that because of, you know, you'd lost your dog or your job or something like that. I'm curious.
Okay.
How you'd feel if you started walking again.
Mm-hmm. Whitney, do you see what he did? He just moved the goalpost a little bit though. He just, they wanted a flat tire fix, and he just turned them into investigators into their own symptomology.
Yeah. That seems like too a really interesting segue. We should have had this discussion right after our interoception piece that we did, because there seems like there's a lot of that going on there, a heightened degree of tuning into what they're feeling and how that's related.
What they're feeling, but also just reflecting on it. Oh yeah, I did feel better after that walk. Jeez, heck, catching that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the thing about a complex health problem is that almost anything can potentially make it worse. And people start to realize that when they've become sensitive people, and then any disturbance in their environment they realize that that can bother them. They realize that sleeping in the wrong bed or eating the wrong foods can flare them up. Well, that means that there's many, many, many different things that can make them feel better too. And it's complex, it's individual. They're the only one that's going to be able to learn what these things are. And so I want to make them curious about all these different influences and start exploring them, figure out which factors matter, which ones don't.
Yeah.
And right. Because those are all under their control too.
What do you two think about the idea that we are in some ways models, that we just by who we are inspire a certain approach or being or way of being with our own bodies, for example? Is that like?
Well, I think, yeah, clearly people look to us to be those models for them, whether or not we kind of see ourselves that way or intend to. I think it's a natural process of somebody when you're going to seek care from some individual that you're looking to them to be some type of a model of better care and better health that you would want to aspire to.
Yeah. I mean, I some of my clients, my story is there that I used to be in a lot of pain and now I'm not. And, you know, sometimes I'll frame what I think they might try to do in terms of like what I would do. Like I might say something like, I don't know if this is a good idea, but I'll very often say, you know, if I were in your position, I would be curious about how strength training would help that shoulder. Like if I had this problem, that's one of the first things I'd try. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know if it would work, but you know what I mean? I don't know if that's a good way to talk about it, but sometimes I will talk that way.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
Sounds good to me. Well, it puts you in the equation. You're owning it and you're offering it as an option for them to try and own if they want to. I mean, I'm just always aware too that when people finally do find a place in my schedule, pay my fee, get to see me, come to see me, that they've already invested a bunch into their own feeling better. They've already performed a bunch of the setup for this important ritual we do of getting people on our tables and working with them. And it's such an honor almost to be the, I almost think about it like I'm not a football guy, so I'm probably going to blow the analogy, but the guy that comes and kicks the field goal, you know, it's all been set up and I just show up and do that one thing that it, you know, gets the point or whatever. But there's so many other factors there.
And disrespectful for the football kicker. You disrespected yourself and the kicker.
And for him, as long as you make the kick too. So
yeah, that guy could be
the hero or the goat. Yeah.
maybe it's a bad analogy then, because you're right. Yeah. Then it turns it down to either making the kick or not. And sometimes it is just the being together and just the hanging out in a cool situation and feeling better.
Yeah.
That has the effect that we're both looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. So before we wrap it up, I mean, I just had a couple interesting things. You talked about cognitive functioning in your article. The brain fog thing is, you know, something people are thinking about a lot.
Yeah, I don't know. The brain fog, I'm not sure I've ever experienced that myself. So when people say that they've got brain fog, I'm not exactly sure what it means, but a lot of people say I've got brain fog and they mean they're having cognitive difficulty and it runs along with, especially it seems like chronic fatigue and post-viral type things. And the long COVID people say that they've got brain fog.
Yep.
And I think that they've found that people with Alzheimer's, cognitive decline, and self-diagnosed brain fog have higher levels of neuroinflammation when they look at them, look at that under, you know, a device that can find it.
As a chronic Lyme, former chronic Lyme sufferer, for sure, brain fog was my friend, my constant companion. I knew exactly what they meant. And it makes a whole lot of sense to me that as the body is recovering from or responding to or reacting to an infection that has ongoing effects in the immune system or other ways we don't know, that there are cognitive effects that you just can't think as well. And there, you know, there's some that interesting research that say, you know, explain pain goes into and such, where they talk about how different inflammatory cytokines increase our cognitive abilities and others reduce it. So the tendency being is the more inflammatory things are, the worse our spatial memory is, the worse things like that are, and the more anti-inflammatory, the clearer and quicker our operations get. Mm-hmm. It's a generalization they play off of, but it made a whole lot of sense for me having gone through that. Uh-huh. And air pollution. I don't miss that one. You mentioned that in your article as well.
Air pollution is just incredibly bad for you. It's unbelievable how much research there is out there. Some of it very kind of interesting, some of it very kind of factoidy. Like there's so many different ways that they've tried to measure how it's bad. I think like referees make more mistakes on days with high air pollution and judges more often in their decisions, and people don't do as well on tests when there's high air pollution. And then on population levels, you can find all sorts of health discrepancies based on how much air pollution there is. Yeah, but the cool thing about air pollution is it varies by day in certain cities. And then so you can track certain types of things.
Yeah.
And then they've got, I think they've got kind of a mechanistic understanding of how it kind of gets in there and crosses the blood-brain barrier and causes the neuroinflammation. And it's not really for us massage therapists to be able to correct the air pollution, but in the voting booth, that's an important thing to get done. And I suppose, you know what, that there are ways you can probably modify your local
Local environment, but certainly behavior, like in the voting booth, in the driver's seat, or whatever it is, the choices we make. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, in your house, you can get air filters and stuff like that. Yeah. I haven't looked into that too much, but I guess I concluded that my air is pretty healthy in my house right now, but I was thinking of getting one of those machines,
You're in Seattle, huh?
Yeah.
So you got that great Puget Sound effect going on there and all that moisture.
Except for the summer everything's on fire. Yeah.
I mean, we lucked out this year. We did not have that much smoke. How did you do Whitney?
It was awful. It was really bad this year.
Said in the 400s, Whitney.
Yeah, it was in the 400s. Like it was the kind of thing like, we're duct taping the windows and putting blankets on the, in front of the doors and everything and not going outside because it was really bad.
We were very bad here in Colorado too. Very bad. So it's an ongoing and will be an ongoing continuing concern.
Mm-hmm. You guys make the homemade air filters with a box fan and a MERV 13?
I saw some things like that on the web. I've got some high performance air filters in my office anyway, because I have these parrots in there and they put out this dust that's really bad for my respiratory. So I got to have this air filters running most of the time anyway.
Parrot dander removers.
Yeah, good. Exactly.
So, well, yeah, maybe we should look for like an air filter company to be a podcast sponsor.
Hey, there you go. Like yeah. Clean your life.
That's good.
With the super pure
box fan, MERV 13 filter, blow the fan through the filter. I did that last summer when we had a lot of smoke. The thing was like brown within 2 weeks. And I was like, that would be in my brain right now.
That would be in your brain and elsewhere. What's a MERV 13 filter? What is that?
Well, the air filters have different filtering capacity. And so you need to get up to like an 11 before you're catching the fine particles that smoke. So it just, some of the filters, the kinds you have in your house are probably like a 6 or a 7 because it takes a ton of air pressure to blow through it when it's really
dense.
So that's a rating.
It gets out all the dust particles.
Okay, everybody, this episode was brought to you by Todd Hargrove and his MERV 13 plans right off of YouTube.
Yep.
Go check it out.
There's your side hustle, Todd. Building air filters.
You can't hustle it because it's so easy to do homemade. You get a box fan, $20. The filter's $10.
Yeah.
Go to Home Depot and get some duct tape and put it together.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. All right. We'll do it.
Well, what else? What else do you want to make sure we touch in on? What are your closing thoughts? That kind of thing, Todd.
Well, You can find me at toddhargrove.substack.com.
All right. There's one takeaway. That's one. But it's, I mean, it's been fun to talk to you and just hear your take on these things, of course. But again, just to start to get deeper into this idea that every thing going on with our clients, it has some sort of story behind it, some sort of mechanism. And they're, even though they're complex, sometimes the ways that people respond to them don't have to be. Yeah, I'm going to leave you with.
Yeah, simple solutions to complex problems. That's a good phrase, right?
Yeah.
What do you think, Whit?
All right. Well, that sounds good. Well, I think we can consider it a wrap there for today. Then I think, Todd, thank you again so much for coming to visit with us today and and hang out and jump into some fascinating discussions here. And hopefully we'll do it again sometime down the road as well.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. And would just like to remind everybody to check out Todd's podcast. It's a great, another great show that's out there. Better Movement is the name of the podcast. That's correct, isn't it, Todd? Yeah.
Yes.
And also put a plug in there for some of his other resources and things that are on the website, because there's some fascinating stuff in there. So make sure you have a chance to look at that stuff. So, all right, well, we'll wrap it up for the day today. We would like to mention too also that ABMP is proud to sponsor the Thinking Practitioner podcast, and ABMP membership gives massage therapists and body workers exceptional liability insurance, numerous discounts, and great resources to help you thrive, like their ABMP podcast, which is available at abmp.com/podcast or wherever else you happen to listen.
And even if you're not a member, you can get free access to Massage and Bodywork magazine, where Whitney and I are frequent contributors, and special offers for Thinking Practitioner listeners at abmp.com/thinking.
So thank you again to all our sponsors. You can stop by our sites for handouts, show notes, transcripts, and extras. You can find that over at my site at academyofclinicalmassage.com. And Till, where can people find that on yours?
Mine, advanced-trainings.com. If there are questions or things you want to hear us talk about, guests you want us to invite, email us at info@thethinkingpractitioner.com or look for us on social media just under our names. Mine is Till Lukow. What's your name, Whitney Lowe?
Today, my name is Whitney Lowe. You can find me there as well under that. So if you will also please take some time, rate us on Apple Podcasts, as it does help other people find the show. And you can hear us on Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or wherever else you happen to listen. And please do share the word and do tell a friend. And of course, as always, if you're unable to find us in any of those locations, you can tune your tea kettle whistle to Concert C and you will hear us in the residual steam off of that. Thanks again, everybody, for being with us here. Todd, thank you again. Great to speak with you all. And we'll see you again here in a couple weeks.
Thanks, guys.
Steamy. Thank you.